2017 is the 500th anniversary of Protestantism. The question becomes, will it be a birthday or a burial celebration? And let me back up and put that in a little perspective. There are 7 billion people in the world, and of those 7 billion, a little over 2 billion, about 2.2 billion, are Christians. Now, it is not true that Islam is the fastest growing religion in the world. It is still Christianity that is the fastest growing religion in the world. But there's been a massive shift, both in where Christianity is growing and what form of Christianity is. Christianity is no longer growing in the north and the west. It is growing in the south and in the east. So we are seeing a massive shift in the center of gravity of Christianity itself. Actually, the statistical center of gravity right now for Christianity in the world is Timbuktu, ironically. So, not just a shift in the center of gravity, though, but the form of Christianity that is growing is somewhat surprising. Now, this is where there's a little... This is argumentative, how I'm framing this, but I'm going to explain to you the nature of the provocation here. But there's one form of Christianity called Catholicism that has Eastern and Western form. The Western form of Catholicism is called Roman Catholicism. The Eastern form is called, and that comes in a variety of denominations, if you will. Got Greek Orthodox, the Russian Orthodox, and that is growing. Now, you also have another form of Christianity. Now, some would argue that this is an extension of Protestantism. It's another version of Protestantism. And clearly, it came out of the Protestant tradition, which is the second form of Christianity that it was inaugurated in this incredible movement called the Protestant Reformation, of which most of us here have been a part of for 500 years. This third form came out of the Wesleyan component of that, but it didn't manifest itself until this incredible event, early 20th century. It created a new worldwide movement and uprising of the Spirit. And the question is whether this is, you got Catholicism is the first wave, Protestantism is the second wave. Is this a third wave, or is it a derivative of Protestantism in a subcategory of it? Since it, to me, washes against all of the traditions, I tend to think of it as originating with the Protestantism, but creating its own third wave. So I call this whole Pentecostal charismatic movement a third wave of Christianity. Now, some would argue that no, it's still a variant version of Protestantism. You understand where the... Either way, are we talking about a variant version or are we talking about a third wave? I see it as a third wave, and this is the greatest success story in the history of Christianity. Within 100 years, Protestant charismatics comprised, the estimates vary, but nobody says under a quarter. Some say as much as one-third of the worldwide Christian body identifies itself in some fashion as charismatic Pentecostal. The story of this has still not been told. It's an incredible story within Christianity itself. And it is still serving. But there is one form of Christianity that's not growing anywhere. Now, it seems to grow some places because we see mirages, basically. But let's put it in another context. There are about roughly 330,000 churches in the U.S., Christian churches. 75% of them are dying or declining. You say, well, the good news is 25% are growing. Well, 24% are growing from the Alumni Association of the 75%. In other words, we're just seeing hopping and shopping. I call them migrant worshipers. Musical saints. However you want to name it. And I think when the story is written in the last 30, 40 years, what you see is what happens when a Walmart moved in. What happened to the mom-and-pop stores? When a megachurch moved in, what happened to the mom-and-pop churches? See, it's, all we're seeing is the Walmartization of American Christianity. We're not seeing a penetration of the culture for the gospel. So what you've got, basically, is 1%. Basically, 1%. Now, that's 3,300. Now, part of the things I'm optimistic because there's only, a little over 2,000 healthy churches in the U.S. So I'm the optimist here. Some of you have more names in your outlook than this. Of churches that are growing by reaching, interacting, interfacing with their culture. And the biggest challenge that Protestantism has is that nowhere in the world is it able to reproduce itself. And the worst crisis any species can have is a reproduction crisis. And when you cannot reproduce yourself, either in your children, or in your church children, or in the culture, and that means, that's a word that we don't like to talk about called evangelism. You can't do any of those. You are an endangered species. So, what do we celebrate at the 500th anniversary of Protestantism? And does Protestantism have a future? Is Protestantism dead or isn't it? One of the, and you can, the implication is of what we talked about this morning, is that Protestantism has so wedded itself to book culture, to print culture, to a rational, logical, linear, enlightenment, left-brain mentality that it cannot make the transition to a much more right-brain world, to a much more TGIF culture, a much more apple than orange world. And that's one of the questions. In many ways, when you look at Pentecostalism and you look at, for example, Eastern Orthodoxy, Eastern Orthodoxy is basically, they're structurally almost identical because both of them are epic. In other words, they're working off of an epic canvas. Now, one paints by numbers. Eastern Orthodoxy paints by numbers on that epic canvas. The other one is, ironically, the Pentecostals are much more abstract artists. But they both are operating off an epic canvas. In other words, Eastern Orthodoxy is basically Pentecostalism in drag. And Derek, I will not tweet that. But you got to remember that because that's basic. So we're dealing with highly experiential worship that is highly participatory, very image rich, and very relational, very connective. All of which Protestantism is having trouble making a transition towards. Hence the importance of you. And your role in this time that God has raised up for you. And so what we're talking about in this conversation about the very nature of of how we interact with the culture and what kind of interface that we use is a key to whether, indeed, Protestantism, we celebrate a birthday or a burial in 2017.
Nice.
You know, liberation theology chose the poor, but the poor chose the Pentecostals for a reason. Because at least the Pentecostals are addressing seriously their economic hungers, dreams, and ambitions, and desires, and we're just, you know, oh, celebrate your poverty. We poeticize poverty. Tell somebody poor that that's poetry.
Right.
So, yeah.
You think the ethnic nature of the Pentecostal Catholic is conscious and intentional?
No. I think it's just the way in which I think it's just the way in which they are interacting with the culture as it has emerged. And they're much more street savvy, much more open to where the spirit is, and so they've been more able to address people where they are, the common touch. One of the things that the Bible says about Jesus is the common people heard him gladly. Remember that? And one of our problems is that we've lost the common touch. And when you lose the common touch, and this is where I blame and partly theological education here, because we train people in a faith different from their people, and then we don't build bridges back to connect with them to their people. So, no, never lose the common touch. And Pentecostals have never lost the common touch.
Yeah. Would you say Pentecostals all over the world, Pentecostals outside of America? Because Pentecostals in America, any of the major denominations like the Assemblies.
I do not look at Assemblies of God as Pentecostals anymore. And,
right, right.
I have friends there, but
right.
They become Protestants.
Right, exactly.
Don't tweet me on some of these.
Hey, now, I was an Assemblies of God minister, so yeah. I agree with you totally.
All right. What I want to do this afternoon, I want to step back a little bit because I'm going to push you a little bit because I want to deal with this control issue, which I think is part of our dilemma. But I want to come at it a little different than you're expecting. So I want to argue this afternoon that prayer is the most powerful force in the universe. Now, that's not a very Protestant thing to do, but let me repeat, prayer is the most powerful force in the universe. Repeat after me, insects crawl.
Insects crawl.
Fish swim.
Fish swim.
Birds fly.
Birds fly.
Animals run.
Animals run.
Humans pray.
Humans pray.
Try again. Insects crawl.
Insects crawl.
Birds fly.
Birds fly.
Fish swim.
Fish swim.
Animals run.
Animals run.
Humans pray.
Humans pray.
One of the biggest questions of the future is what makes human human? What does it mean to be a human? Let me tell you, it's going to be a huge. And one of the things that makes humans human is humans what?
Prayer.
What makes us distinctively, uniquely human? But to prove to you theologically that prayer is the most powerful force in the universe, I gotta dematerialize your thinking. I'm gonna rematerialize it at the end, but I need to dematerialize it first. So let me back up. It's not easy being one of my kids. Okay, let me start with that. But as I tell them that every commercial tells them the gospel's wrong, I also tell them that this is what every commercial says. This is why the gospel's wrong. Because every commercial argues it's the trees that move the wind. Every commercial is an anti-gospel. Because it presents a story beautifully presented, wonderfully told. Learn from how they're telling it. But every commercial says, it's the trees that move the wind. It's the trees that move the wind. The most powerful force in this universe are physical, material forces. It's the trees that move the wind. Now, we've been trained not by might, not by power, but what? But by programs. We've been trained to think it's the trees that move the wind. Just get the right program. Get the right blueprint. God didn't give us a blueprint to map our way through life. God gave us a blue sky to enjoy and to fly in. But we want the blueprint. We don't want the blue sky. And the wild blue yonder. But even if we don't, okay, it's not programs, but in my tribe, I come from a tribe called Methodist. Have you ever heard of that tribe? Some of you from that tribe. We have another one. Right? We not only do, it is by programs, we have another one. Not by might, not by power, not by programs, but it is by process. Just trust the process. Let me know what I'm talking about. Sorry, it's not by might, not by power, not by programs, not by process, but it's by God's Spirit. The most fundamental powerful forces in this universe are not physical material forces, they are spiritual invisible forces. And, actually, the trees honor the supremacy of the wind, because it is the wind that blows and moves the trees. Because whenever the wind blows, what do the trees do? They bow and they bend and pay homage to the supremacy of the wind. The power is in the invisible, not the visible. What are you taking with you into eternity? What's visible or invisible? What's seen or unseen? But everything about this culture says the wind moves the trees. I mean, the trees move the wind. The trees move the wind. The trees move the wind. It's the power of the wind. That's one of the reasons why I still love to play with words. I'm trying to become an image smith, but I'll always be a wordsmith too. And I love the word astronaut. Can you all say that?
Astronaut.
It almost uses all the muscles in your mouth. But it literally means not as a nautical word, it means sailor. Astro means star. So an astronaut is literally a sailor of the stars. Isn't that beautiful? A cosmonaut is a sailor of the cosmos. I got thinking, you know, the Greek word for wind is pneuma. Also means spirit. Ah, that's what disciples of Jesus are. Pneumonauts. Sailors of the Spirit. But it's kind of scary to sail the Spirit. Because we are all basically tree huggers. not in a good way. I love trees, and we've been all love trees. But we'd rather be tree huggers than spirit surfers. Because it's a lot safer to hug trees than to sail the wind. But we've got to start trusting the Spirit, trusting the wind, trusting the Spirit. Now, and we can talk the language, trust the Spirit. But we want that Spirit to have a blueprint, a program, a process. And then we'll trust it. There was an experiment done a long time ago, a couple centuries ago, before they knew anything about biology and photosynthesis and stuff like that. And this guy, he was a gardener, was trying to figure out, you know, where does all this mass come from? And so he took a little corkscrew willow. Anybody know what a corkscrew willow is? A little sprig. They grow fast. Need a lot of water. But he took this little sprig of a corkscrew willow and planted it in this big barrel of dirt, measured the weight of the dirt and the weight of the corkscrew willow, left it outside for 5 years, and then 5 years came back to it. And he then measured the weight of the corkscrew willow and then measured the weight of the soil. Because the question is, in his mind, again, it's hard for us to think this before science, but, or as we know science, but the question is, where did all this mass come from? Well, it's got to come from, he thought, the soil. Right? So he measures the corkscrew willow, and now weighs 193 pounds. It initially weighed 3 ounces. He then measures the dirt, and it found out it has only lost 13 ounces. In 5 years, the dirt has lost 13 ounces, but it's the tree has gotten 193 pounds worth of mass. So this guy is going, well, where did all that mass, weight, matter, material come from? Now, we're sophisticated people, so we know the answer to that. We know that during the dark phase of photosynthesis, God has so admirably arranged this universe that our waste product is something called carbon dioxide, which is poisonous to us, but it's the very life breath of something called a tree. So the tree breathes in what is our waste product, and its inhalation is our exhaustion, exhalation, but it takes that carbon dioxide, and during the dark phase, it separates the carbon from the oxygen, and it keeps the carbon to itself, from which it makes fiber, but it releases back to us the oxygen, which enables us to breathe. And so even that tree grows out of thin air. The power is in the invisible. Even in biology, powers in the invisible. But we've not been trained to trust the invisible. To trust the Spirit. Now, I want to bring it up to 1929. The church is still stuck in a Newtonian science when we've had the 20th century dedicated to Einstein, and now we're post-Einstein, because we know Einstein was wrong about a lot of things. But let's just bring it up in Einstein. In 1905, Einstein published three little essays which revolutionized the world. And these three essays, in some ways, we still haven't come to terms with in the church, but it is now 1929. And Sir Arthur Eddington is a Quaker physicist in London, and he is addressing the Royal Academy of Sciences. These are all the greatest scientists of Europe come together for their annual meeting. And he stands in front of these scientists at a wooden table, no lectern, a wooden table. He's standing behind a table lecturing. And he goes, we're coming up on the 25th anniversary of Einstein's amazing discovery of this little formula that unlocks the secret of the universe. And isn't it amazing how the secrets of the universe can be unlocked in the simplest of formulas? Four letters, one number, or three letters, one number, and that is E equals what? E stands for? M stands for? C stands for? Square. And so he says, I'm not sure that any of us yet have gotten this, so let me try again to understand as we come up to the 25th anniversary of Einstein's formula, what this means. He said, so if you understand this formula, E equals MC squared, and he knocks on the wooden table. What is this table? Is this matter or energy? Of course, this is 1929, and they all say what?
Matter.
He goes, well, let me try again. Now it's harder. Is this substance or is this spirit? And they all, in 1929, they all said, what?
Substance.
He goes, okay, if you understand Einstein, the correct answer is both. He said, but if I got to pick one or the other, let me tell you, I'm not picking matter. If I got to pick one or the other, I'm not picking substance. He said, this basically, right here, this table, it's more energy than matter. It's more spirit than substance. He said, I'll prove it to you. We're going to keep this table with all of its substance. I'm just going to rearrange the molecules. So it'll still be a table. We're just going to rearrange its molecular form. Anybody got a match? We'll see how much matter matters. You and I are the human organization of energy. I tell students, whenever you stand in front of your people, realize this, you're basically full of holes. You're basically empty space. And the only question is, what spirit do you allow to fill that empty space? Because fundamentally, if you took everybody in this universe, 7 billion people, got rid of all the matter, just rearranged it into energy form, I mean, just got rid of all the energy, just rearranged it into molecular form, into matter form, it would fill the space of one big beach ball you could drop into the Grand Canyon. That's how little matter there is to us. We are basically spirit become flesh. Spirit matters. The primacy is with the spirit that takes flesh form. So even in the Einsteinian world, we are seeing the supremacy of something other than material, physical. We're seeing the supremacy of the invisible. Yes. The wind. The spirit. That comes first. Spirit matters. Did you see that? If I put it one word, spirit matters. You and I are the human organization of spirit. The only question is, what spirit do you allow to fill you? What spirit do you allow to indwell within you? H.G. Wells once said that at 50, everybody gets the face they deserve. Because spirit, what? Matters. What you allow to fill you becomes manifest. Now let me take it one step further, because we are now post-Einstein. So, let's cut to the chase. I'm going to give you, unfortunately, this should have been done in Houston. We abandoned it. I mean, it's such an embarrassment how second-rate this country is becoming, but don't get me going on this. But The only place you can still see telephone poles is in the U.S. Every place, everybody else got them underground. They're, you know, they're thinking wireless, they're thinking cable. We're still putting up telephone poles and wires. And we're still doing that in our churches, in our thinking, in our thoughts. But this is called the, at CERN in Switzerland, there's this collider. It started off in Houston, and we abandoned the project. And so the Europeans said, we'll take it up. And what is now, it's something having to do with something called superstring physics, which is it has been kind of a theory, but now it's being proven by this Large Hadron Collider. To be true, and if you want to read about superstring physics, let me give you somebody to listen to. His name is Brian Greene, and he's like in his early 40s, young guy, teaches at Columbia University's field of superstring physics, because he's a superstring theorist. But he wrote a book called The Elegant Universe. I love this book because he's making a case for the fact that this world is so beautiful, it's just so elegant, that there has to be some grand organizing design behind it. Now, he says, I'm not going to talk about God. I refuse to talk about God. I want to get in that whole God discussion. But I do want to make a case that there is a grand organizing design. It's just so beautiful, so elegant. And by the way, y'all get it, the acronym for Grand Organizing Design. But he's not going to talk about God. But maybe there's a Grand Organizing Designer. But he's not going to talk about it. But in this book, this is the current reigning definition of matter. So we've got the supremacy of energy, the supremacy of spirit, established by Einstein. But now we're at a point where this is what matter is according to superstring physics. Are you ready? Okay. Now I'm going to give it to you. There's a lot of schools. I'm going to give you one school first. Vibrating strings of energy. That is the reigning orthodox definition of matter according to superstring physics. Now, there's some say it's not strings, it's threads. Another school says, no, it's not threads, it's loops. Okay? So we got the string school, the thread school, the loop school. But let me give it to you again. Vibrating, I'm going to go with strings. Of what? Energy. That's matter. So they're even defining matter now in non-material form. Or, let me give you a... Now, some of you, if you understand what I'm just saying now, you ought to be doing job illusions or hallelujahs or triple hallelujahs or something, right? Because, let me say, the question is, to these strings or loops or threads, there are multiple dimensions. Now, we know three dimensions, but superstring physics says no, 10, 11, or maybe 26 different dimensions. Which means what? They have no idea. They have no idea. But they know there's more than three. And Brian Greene goes, you know, in these other dimensions, some dimensions, just as we have gravity that goes down, another dimension thinks could go up. And another dimension thinks could go across. He goes, so you got to be constantly open in life to being surprised and ambushed by the strange and the unusual and the weird, because it could be the leakings into our dimensions of some of these other dimensions. So always be open to things that seem impossible. I'm reading this book and I'm going, you got, here are these scientists more open to being surprised by the spirit than Christians. But let's get real here. Vibrating strings of energy. Anything that vibrates does what?
Sounds.
Creates frequencies, and frequencies create sound. So we have just been told by super string physicists that the, you know what matter is?
Music. Music of the universe, Alice.
You've just been told, people, worship people, that the fundamental reality of matter itself is music. Now, okay, you knew that. But you now got scientific proof. In other words, you build a church from the sound of. You build all of life from the sound of. In other words, each one of you is an unrepeatable, irreplaceable song. And the greatest developmental task in life is to discover the song that God made you and to sing it ravishingly for the glory of God. And that's your job. In worship, that's precisely your job. Is to help people find the song that God made. And here's the problem, though. You get a bunch of 5-year-olds together, how many of you sing? Every hand goes up. You get a bunch of 12-year-olds together, ask how many of you sing. One hand goes up, because between 5 and 12, they professionalize singing into, well, we have one singer. What happens between 5 and 12 if everybody loses their song? And maybe spends the rest of their life trying to find it, or to sing somebody else's song. This is my Father's world, and to my listening ears, all nature sings, and round me the music of the spheres. The best translation of "And God said, let there be light," Leonard Bernstein, whenever he directed this Genesis Mass, when he came to this point, he would look out at the crowd and say, "Once you get this right," now this is not exactly true, but he said the best translation of Hebrew is not "and God said," it's "and God sang, let there be light." And then sometimes he went on to say, and I tell you the first four notes God sang, do I hear them? Da 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 da! Let there be light. But he's not far wrong. To see creation itself as we have a language for it. The big, well, it's a big sound that begins the music of the spheres. As God said, sang, let there be light. I want you to hear this. Sound becomes sight. Over and over again, sound becomes sight. We've been led astray by the leadership literature to think that the primary spiritual organ is the eye. No, the primary spiritual organ is the ear. It is not the eye gate. The eye gate is very deceitful and deceptive, and you can't trust it. That's why God gave you eyelids, to cleanse your eyes every few seconds, because your eyes create illusions, mirages. I put a pencil in a glass, and you see an optical illusion. You can't trust your eyes, because your eyes take you into the world. Your ears take the world into you. You can trust your ears. Faith comes by
hearing.
Faith is less about vision than vibration. Vibration comes first. In a biblical sense, you don't see a vision, you what? Hear a vision. If you see a vision, it is probably yours, not God's. First manifestation of the Spirit of Pentecost is what? Wind. You hear it, and then you see it. I have not seen Jurassic Park. It's now come out in 3D. Has it made the movies yet, the 3D version?
Yes, it's coming.
But I love that movie. My favorite image in the whole movie is the lawyer in the outhouse. And you want to do the image for the church, you know. It's the lawyer in the outhouse sitting there reading his print, stuck with his, you know, book culture. The whole world outside has changed. But what's the first manifestation that has changed? Vibration. You feel, you hear it, you feel it, the vibration, and then by the time you see it, it's too late. You're T-Rex food. And we're becoming T-Rex food because we're waiting to see it. What's your vision? We have a vision for this. No, the vision is Christ. That's our vision. But you hear before you see. You hear a vision before you see the vision. In the medieval world, by the way, up until the Renaissance, when they painted pictures of the Mary's conception, you have a ray from heaven to her ear. Exactly. Spirit goes in the ear. That's how the conception of Christ occurred. The ear gate is the primary gate for birth, for spiritual birth. Yeah.
That goes back to touch as well. Because, you know, I keep thinking Helen Keller. She couldn't hear. She could still feel, and vibration is about
vibration
feeling.
Vibration is key, yeah.
Is about feeling.
Yeah, exactly. Let me just be real quick here. Let me give you a narrator. I'm going to end this little section with a narrator. So, there it is. Yeah, that's great. Did you get the lawyer in the outhouse?
One epic video.
Here's what prayer is. And I want to, I grew up, we couldn't have a TV because it was against our religion. Although my father did get a TV when I was 9, because he wanted to watch Bonanza.
Yeah.
You know, Bonanza is what destroyed Sunday night worship. American culture decided Bonanza or Sunday night worship. But answer one, you don't go up against the culture on its own terms. But up until I was 9, I grew up watching the radio. Some of you have no idea what I'm talking about. But did anybody here know you're watching the radio? Okay, so we gathered around the radio and we watched it. And we were very poor, so we didn't have a current radio. It was an old radio. It had knobs on it. You had to turn on and on. It was really clunky. Yeah. So we would gather around this thing. But here is what your you are vibrating strings of energy. You are a musical instrument. And the question for you is, where are you going to tune that, and to what are you going to tune that instrument to? And what frequencies is it going to vibrate to? And this is the function of worship. Here's what prayer is. You turn off, like I got a nod here. I should have had push buttons, but I'm giving you a nod because that's all I grew up. You turn off the frequencies of the world, the white noise, the static, the dissonance. You turn off the frequencies of your life to the frequencies of the world, and you turn on the frequencies of your life to the frequencies of God's Spirit. Now, as soon as you turn on, you realize how out of tune you are. So then you got to go through some tune-ups. The question is, how do you tune up? And how do you tune the frequencies of your... And this is more than a metaphor here. You understand what I'm saying? I mean, this is literally physics. To what do you tune the frequencies of your spirit to? And how do you tune them? Well, God gave us a tuning fork to the eternal. And that tuning fork has a name. And that name is Jesus the Christ, God's perfect pitch. And when we tune our lives to Him, now you tune up through a lot of things as you tune your lives to Him. You tune up through prayer, through song, through readings, through meditation, through all those things that you call worship, and all that goes with worship in a variety of forms. But worship is the tuning up. Now there comes a time when through these tune-ups, and that tuning that are directed by this perfect pitch called Jesus the Christ, that the frequencies of your spirit will match the frequencies of Christ's spirit. Now, what happens when you have frequencies that match? It's a technical term for it, and it's called resonance. Now, when resonance is reached, there's an explosion of energy. My brother went to Princeton, a Methodist, and came out a Presbyterian. You ever heard of that tribe? But I don't worry about him too much because he married well. And he married an opera diva. She's now, she was departmental chair, I know she still is, in the voice choir at Westminster Choir College. But she did sing in the Met for many years. Sharon Sweet, she did the dramatic soprano parts, the Aida, the role, all that stuff. And she toured a lot in Europe, but she had a problem when she was practicing her scales, because sometimes, now Caruso could do this at will, but sometimes, if I remember the Memorex commercial?
Yeah.
But the frequencies of a note, just a note, match the frequencies of something else in a room, like a glass or a pane of glass. In other words, resonance is reached, there's an explosion of energy, and something's got to give. And it's not going to be my sister-in-law. So that glass or that pane of glass reaches for a higher level of being. A new state of existence. How do you think the walls of Jericho came tumbling down? Reread the story. They created vibrations, and then... Why do you think soldiers throughout history, whenever they come to a bridge, they have to do what?
Stand still.
Why do they break step?
Break up the resonance.
Bingo. Because just the frequencies of their steps can create a note that will bring down the bridge. In other words, you got this? A song is stronger than a stone bridge, a steel bridge, any kind of bridge. Just the frequencies. The song is more powerful than steel, stone, whatever you can bring. And so the soldiers break step so they don't blow up the bridge. When the frequencies of our spirit resonate with the frequencies of Christ's spirit, that's called resonance. When resonance is reached, something has got to give, and it's not going to be Jesus. And we become, what's the word? New creatures. Born into His Spirit. Born of His Spirit. And we begin to live his resurrection life, and he shares his resurrection life with us as he lives his resurrection life in and through us. And in that state of resonance, without Christ, I can do nothing, but with Christ, in that resonance, I can do what? Well.